From rays of the one light, abiding in God, truth is one and eternal. Realize oneness with it in your deathless self within. The following commentary is based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Yogananda often emphasized, more often to his disciples than to the general public, but also to everyone generally, for it was a universal teaching, the importance of attunement. For divine understanding cannot be created, it must be perceived. To the disciples, Yogananda spoke of the importance of attunement with the Guru. To others, he urged the importance, at least of attuning oneself to higher consciousness. Can an eagle rise without support from the sustaining air? Jesus Christ said in the Gospel of St. John, chapter 15, I am the vine, ye are the branches. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit, for without me ye can do nothing. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch and is withered. And men gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. If ye abide in me, and my words abide in you, ye shall ask what ye will, and it shall be done unto you. Herein is my Father glorified, that ye bear much fruit, so shall ye be my disciples. How can we abide in him? Jesus says, if my words abide in you. By words, he meant not only his spoken words, but his vibrations, his consciousness, of which the words are only an expression. We must abide by the teachings, but we must also absorb those teachings into ourselves, that they become our own experience. For disciples of this path, the more in their hearts they live consciously in the presence of the Masters, the more they will find the divine presence living within them. And for all truth seekers, whether disciples or not, the more they live sustained inwardly by the awareness of God's presence, the higher they will find themselves soaring in wisdom and joy. For the Bhagavad Gita says in the 10th chapter, I am the source of everything. From me all creation emerges. Blessed with this realization, the wise, awe-stricken, adore me. Thus, through Holy Scripture, God has spoken to mankind. Om. 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 When you read Master's teachings in his different books, in his lessons, you find that he gives general teachings for everyone. It was amazing to us how much he dwelt in person with the disciples on the question, as I said here, of attunement. What is attunement? If it's so important, what does it really mean? It does not mean being a yes man. It does not mean just absolutely absorbing without thinking what he said. I think it's very important to think through what he said, to try to understand the inner meaning, because so often behind his words there were other meanings. I've often given you an illustration of the way he taught, because he did not do the way you would expect one to do, who was your teacher, sit you down, perhaps on the other side of a desk, or perhaps lying down on a psychiatrist's couch or something or other, and say, now listen, do you remember when you did such and such, and do you see what that means? And he didn't talk like that at all. Often it would be just a word. There was this one time when he asked me a question about astronomy. I had wanted to be an astronomer when I was young, and so I I thought, well, he was just asking for information. So he said, well, what keeps the earth from merging in the sun? And I said, well, that's its centrifugal force that makes it keep wanting to spin out into space. And he paused a moment. I thought, well, I guess he's understood that one. And then he said, well, in that case, why doesn't it fly out into space? And I said, well, that's the magnetic power of the sun. It's gravitational pull, which keeps it bound by centripetal force to the orbit, to orbiting around the sun. He didn't say anything. You'd think he would have said, now you see what that means? One, two, three. Nothing. About 6 months later, I thought, wait a minute. He was speaking an allegory of the soul and God. That we don't merge back into God because of our desires, our worldly impulses, our thoughts of doing this and doing that. And yet we can't get away from God, no matter how we try, because His love is always there in the heart, always pulling. You can't get away from Him, and yet how hard people try. But what a wonderful way to teach. He made you meet Him halfway. He didn't explain it all to you, often with, as I said, just a word. I remember one time, I had been in a slight mood, and I saw him, and he said, how are you, Walter? I said, well, that's good. That was his teaching. Don't you see? He wanted you to be positive. Enough of these little vague humors. Always be strong. Always be positive. I could not have said, honestly, yes, I'm great. But he wanted me to start thinking that way. Often, I was upset with him one time. Here he wanted me to develop devotion. I was much too intellectual. I wanted to develop devotion. I thought that that meant that I should give up thinking. I should give up being intellectual and just develop my heart. Well, he was trying to help me to understand that it isn't a question of either or. Develop both. And so here I was working hard on chanting and all of that. And he told me to write articles for the magazine. And I kept meaning to do it. But after all, I worked all day and I meditated all evening. And he asked me a few weeks later, how was I coming with the articles? And I said, well, sir, I don't have time for that. I'm meditating. He says, write the articles. Take time from your meditation. And I thought, well, gee, I mean, that's what we're here for. How come? But we're here for more than work or doing things or even meditating. We're here to be in tune. And through meditation, we get in tune. Through work, we can be in tune. Anything that we do with the right motive helps us to achieve that attunement, as I've learned repeatedly. But I became a little upset with him because I thought, well, he's trying to take me away from the very thing he wants me to develop. And then I felt remorseful, and I wrote him a note saying, I'm sorry. Well, he's phoned me, and he said, your note is absolutely inexplicable. What do you mean? And I said, I'm sorry, sir, I was upset with you because of this reason. You know, he didn't sit down and explain that it was good to develop both reason and feeling, that I would do that to people. He didn't do that. He just made you meet him halfway. As a result, many people fled. Because he would not meet them on that level. And so all he said, now mind you, this is some counseling, right? Living for God is martyrdom. What kind of answer was that? I just knew that it had to be the right answer. But it took me a while to figure it all out. And in fact, this is what I learned, that the teaching that he gave me, I've spent, what, 54 years, 50 years, in fact, since his passing, meditating on what he said, how he said it, the spirit with which he said it, the expression with which he said it, because I found that in every little nuance, there was a deep meaning. I remember sitting at his feet one time. He was editing the Gita, and I was working with him on that. But at this time, he was just working on the manuscript, and I was sitting at his feet and thinking, what a blessing it was to be his disciple and to be with him. He didn't say anything, he just kept editing. But then when he was ready, when he had finished what he was doing, he asked me to help him to his feet, and he looked me in the eyes and he said, just a bulge of the ocean. There was so much love, so much joy. You don't need lessons when you get a contact like that. He taught you through that contact. He taught you through his vibrations. Now, how do you get in tune with a vibration? Well, the most important thing, you can't agree with everything, but you shouldn't disagree out of respect. Nonetheless, why agree if you don't agree? Why agree if you don't understand? Shelve it. Don't worry about it. You're not going to understand everything. But the basic man and what he represented was so entirely what I wanted. I wanted his joy. I wanted his love. I wanted his wisdom. I wanted his vibration. I have met other great masters, and I haven't felt drawn to them. It isn't that I didn't feel they were great masters, but master is mine. When you reach that point of understanding that this is yours, I remember I got into a discussion. He was trying to argue, I was trying to discuss. And this man was trying to convert me to his church. And I was saying, well, you know, truth can be expressed in so many ways. You can't say that it's only this, only that. He wouldn't buy any of it. I had to belong to his church. I finally said, look, your way may be better than mine, but I could not be sincere following it. This is my way. It's sort of like your own mother. There may be better women in the world than your own mother. I doubt it, of course, but nonetheless, it's possible. And yet, she's yours. And so with Master, beyond his greatness, which I never found anybody to meet it, but I wasn't sitting there saying, who's counting? You know, I wasn't measuring. He was mine. He is mine. And this is what attunement means, when you really decide this is the way you want to go. Now, not everybody reaches that point, but it's a very important point to try to open yourself to, because otherwise, well, okay, Dhirananda was a disciple of his who betrayed him, who turned against him, who tried to destroy him financially, and caused him a lot of trouble in this country. He was from India. In fact, it's a curious story because Master, remember that part in the autobiography of a yogi where Sri Yukteswar expressed displeasure to Master's father? And Master went to Sri Yukteswar and said to him, why did you scold me to my own parent? And Sri Yukteswar said, I'll never do it again. But Master went on to say, the only displeasure he had with me at the time was that I was trying to convert, against his gentle remonstrance, a certain person to the path. Well, Dhirananda was that person. Sri Yukteswar knew that he would cause him a great deal of grief. Master knew that he was his disciple and had to. Sri Yukteswar knew that he was disciple and that Master had to. You see, you can't fathom the play of the masters. Master knew that it would cause him trouble. In fact, he told Tulsi Bose in Calcutta when they were about 15, he said, someday he will betray me and marry a white woman. He knew it. When it happened, you'd have thought the roof had come off. You'd have thought that the world had come to an end. He just, you know, when you go to a movie, you're not going to think, now, You've seen it before. You say, oh, now he's going to do this and she's going to do that. You don't think that way. You sort of suspend judgment, pretend you haven't seen it before, and that way you can enjoy it. So a master knows these things, but he goes through the show, and I think he enjoys it a lot more without thinking, yeah, been there, done that. No, not at all. But anyway, you know that every year Master would send him a flat of mangoes. Every year, dear Ananda would send them back unopened. And Master said he will never find God except through this channel, which was ordained for him by God. Once this bond is made, it's something you can't break. There was one disciple, Mr. Cuaron. He was the center leader in Mexico City, a very fine devotee. But Master said to him one time, I lost sight of you for a few incarnations, but now I'll never lose sight of you again. And every now and then, Cuaron would say, now you remember your promise. And Master said, no, I won't lose sight of you again. But you can lose touch for a while. It happens. One time, Norman had a strange vision of Master. Whether it was true or not, I don't really know, but he saw himself with Master on Lemuria. That was some 80,000 years ago, according to legend. And a lot of knowledgeable people say there never was a Lemuria. I just don't know. All I know is that it made me a little worried. And I came to Master, I said, sir, have I been your disciple for thousands of years? Well, he said, it's been a long time, that's all I'll say. I said, well, sir, does it always take so long? He said, oh, yes. Desires for name and fame and this thing and that take them away again and again. Why did he name name and fame? I suppose I had that delusion. Couldn't mean less to me now. But it must have meant something to me before, because even now I know that it's my due. It's happened. Master told me it would happen. But it doesn't mean a thing. Nonetheless, the fact that these desires for the world take one away. You see somebody on the spiritual path who plays the piano very well, and he's a devotee or she's a devotee, and all of a sudden somebody comes who says, why, you could be a concert pianist, you're so good. Concert pianist, wow! And before you know it, she's baying down that false trail, eagerly wanting to become a concert pianist. Maybe she becomes one. If she does, she's more miserable than if she doesn't. Huffing and puffing on the concert circuit? I mean, it's no fun at all. But you find, I know one brother disciple of mine was sort of starry-eyed because somebody had said to him once, you could be a great scientist. And he was all excited about this. In fact, he ended up leaving the path too. And what do you get when you have all those things? You know, there's a very interesting point, and it's infallible. Of all the different things that people can try in this world, and there are, what, millions of them, not one gives them what they want. Not one. They may finally become this or that or the other thing, as they wanted. But having it, they don't like it. Having it, they're disillusioned. Look, I come from a happy family. I remember my father at the age of 85, when he had a heart attack, saying, I have no regrets. I've had a happy life. I have a lot to be grateful for. Was he disillusioned? No, he wasn't. But what a compromise. I used to feel, and this is why I just couldn't stand living in that kind of home. It was such a compromise with the soul's ideal of joy, inspiration. They would sit together. I never saw them argue. I never heard of them arguing. There was great harmony there. But sit together in the evening reading, and I'd be reading with them. And I think, isn't there something more to life than this? And I'm in the middle of something, and Mother says, oh, listen to this. And she reads something. Yeah. Okay. It was such a compromise with what I felt the soul wants. Joy, inspiration, love, cosmic. And here you are stuck in a little chicken coop. It's just not the answer. And so even those people who think they've gotten what they wanted, it's because they've set their sights so low. I mean, really, if you're trying to become a marksman and you aim at a barn door, you're going to hit it. So, but most people are disillusioned. Most people, having wealth, they're unhappy. Having fame, they're unhappy. Ian Fleming said that fame was fun for a while, but now it's just ashes, old boy, just ashes. Everything is ashes. However, there is one, and only one, in all these millions of things that people can do. And it happens in every country, in every religion, in every tradition, every century. Those who have sought God and attained something, hopefully God himself, but at least something, they all have serenity. They all feel this is what life is all about. They're even willing, once they've attained some sort of divine grace, to give their lives for other people. They don't care because they know this is what everybody is seeking. Now, isn't that a pretty cogent argument? That nothing works except one thing? And that one thing has always worked, has never failed. I've never heard of a saint who said, what a scam. They all just, once they get going, they just want it more and more and more. They begin racing. I remember going horseback riding once with a cousin of mine. She was 14. I was 17. She insisted she wanted to go horseback riding. To me, it was the most dull way to spend an afternoon. Sorry, girls. I know that some of you love it. Anyway, as we were driving toward the stable, I began developing this thought in my mind, images of me jumping on the horse's back and clapping my heels into its side and cantering toward the horizon. And so when I saw the horse, I jumped on its back and clapped my heels into its side, and there was a pause. I guess he knew the kind of rider he had. Sort of, what's this? And he sort of shuffled over to a clump of weeds. And then when I finally coaxed him out onto the course, and he sort of, as if he was carrying a dray with a whole bunch of things behind him. But on the way home, he began, well, that's how saints are. Not necessarily plodding on the way out, but the closer they get to the stable, the more eager they are to canter, and the more eager they are to get home. You know, it's not like everything else where the closer you get to the top, the less meaning it is. But the closer you get to God, the more you just want to drop everything. Nothing matters. You know that there's only one thing that matters, God's love. And you're willing to shed everything to attain that. Now, doesn't that give us a message of some sort? I mean, why waste time? People have done your experimenting for you. Yes, the path of yoga says experiment, try it for yourself, see if it works. But there's a pretty cogent argument here too. Lots of people have tried it, it's always worked. Lots of people have tried other things, it's never worked. I'd say that was pretty strong. Seek God, it's the only answer. But how are you going to do it? And here's the real problem. Here you are stuck in an ego. And in the beginning, the ego is a help, because it separates you from the lower animals in this very important respect. They know something's wrong, but they don't quite know that it's happening to them. They don't know that there's something they can do about it. But as man evolves, and as you enter a human body, you have an ego. And that ego tells you, I don't like being unhappy, and I want to do something about it. In the beginning, you think, well, I don't like being unhappy because I'm poor, so I'm going to work to become rich. I don't like being unhappy because I'm lonely, so I'm going to find a wife or a husband. I don't like being unhappy because I'm a slave. I'm going to become a master. And so all these different things that people try in order to achieve what they identify with as success. But then, bit by bit, they discover that one by one these things fall off. And what is left? Finally, okay, yourself. That's all you ever got from the beginning. I met a girl after the Razor's Edge came out. We were all sitting at a coffee table at Brown University. And this girl we were talking about the movie, and this girl said she wanted to go to India and just get lost. Well, I'd just come back from Mexico, where I had tried to get lost. Didn't work. I laughed at her. I said, who are you going to lose? You can't lose the one person you're trying to get away from. You've always got to carry that one around. The ego becomes gradually an obstacle. We want to get out of this little prison of self-consciousness where it's sort of almost pathetic. You sit back and you smile, but you don't say anything. Somebody does something well, and he says, oh, isn't that pretty good? Huh? I always do that kind of thing. Yes, I believe in being efficient. And he goes on and on. And you think, poor fellow, can't he just dump that load for a while and get on with the business of living and enjoying? Somebody sees a beautiful sunset and he thinks, I bet I could do that well. And he's only thinking about how he would paint that sunset, which God has already given him a beautiful one. Why didn't he just enjoy it for a while? We need to be able to drop this self, but it's not easy. How are you going to get from this little pinpoint to infinity? The chasm is infinite. You cannot reason your way into that state. You can accomplish something. You can accomplish some liberty, some self-liberation by realizing that you really aren't that important. Who of us is? Not one of us. I know my friend Rod Brown in high school. He told me he had had the feeling that the other boys were against him. And his mother said to him, Roddy, you aren't important enough to them for them to have to think about you all that much. Well, that was pretty good wisdom, I think. People are too busy thinking of what you think of them. Don't worry about that. But you'll never get out of it except moderately. That is to say, you'll put the dog to rest a little bit, but he'll, as soon as you leave the room, he'll come after you. However, if you can attune yourself to somebody who has that consciousness, he can take you over that chasm. That's what it's about. That's what attunement's about. It's not taking on another personality. If you look at this, the personalities of Yogananda's disciples, each one of them is unique. I would go so far as to say each one of them can be sometimes bizarrely unique. At least, I've been that way, it doesn't matter. The point is that it's not the personality. It's not like, you know, you listen to these Hare Krishna people and they're all talking with an Indian accent. It's a little ridiculous. To be in tune with the Guru is to be in tune with the essence of his consciousness. We say in a way that Ananda began, and this was Mark Stickney's idea, good one. He said the beginning of Ananda was not 1968 when we formally dedicated the retreat up at the meditation retreat. The beginning of Ananda was back in 1949 when Master, you know that picture of him with his hands raised? He was sending out his vibrations into the ether. He said so. He said, I am sowing my thoughts in the ether, and my words shall not die. This blessing that he sent, if you tune into that, you can start communities much more easily. I've done it that way. Not what I wanted, what he wanted. People say sometimes, well, what does Swami want? I don't want anything. But I do want one thing, yes. I want his will. I want his will to express itself And I'm willing to go to the guillotine if necessary to accomplish that end. Because in attunement with that consciousness, I have built Ananda. You'd be amazed how often problems have come up and I just have known the answer. How would I know? Because he's there telling me. I know he's doing it. So many answers, so many solutions to problems. If there were one or two, it would be hit or miss, but they're constant. Those who tune in feel that guidance. If we tune in, and the extent to which we tune in, more happens too. We begin to tune in, not to just what he wants, because he too didn't have any will of his own. It was all God's will. It wasn't that he had any desires, but he wanted to manifest God's will at this time. And as he did so, he, through that attunement, brought a new wave of consciousness into the world. I really feel that Yogananda is the avatar for Dwapara Yuga. He's the power, the manifestation of the divine that is uniquely adapted to this age of energy. Now that is a sentiment. I could be wrong. I couldn't care less. I'm not with him because of that. I'm with him because I'm his. Simple. He could have had a mission to sit under a tree by the Ganges. I'd have been happy to do that. There's no glory in it. It's just attunement, because through that attunement, you find that something much more happens. His Christ consciousness enters into yours, and you begin to feel a change in yourself that you will like very much. You will love feeling this sense of beatitude in everything that you do. You will love feeling that no matter what you do, there's joy in it. You will love feeling that whatever and however people treat you, you feel love. You may not agree, you may not approve, doesn't matter. You can't love, you can't help loving, because that is your consciousness. It's not you. You are simply getting you out of the way so that that love can express. I've often thought, to go back to the simile of the sunset, how beautiful the sunset is, and yet 5 minutes later, gray skies, no longer beautiful. What makes it beautiful? Not the clouds, the sun shining on them. What can make us beautiful is if we let that, through our attunement, let that sun of divine grace and of the guru or the whatever, openness must be there, whether to a guru, whether to anything. If you're open, God will lead you. But through that grace, you find that something happens that is very sweet, and everybody wants it. You know that's what they're really wanting in their hearts. And so often they will say to you, "What have you got that I want?" And that is the time to say, "Well, it's nothing to do with me. But if you do this, this, and this," somebody said to me a few years ago, "You have some wonderful people here." I said, "You know, if you said that, if you saw or met one or two people like that, you could say they are wonderful people. When you see so many, you have to say it's what they're doing that makes them that way." This is a teaching. This is a power. This is a blessing that God has sent into this world. And among many, we're not unique, but we're very grateful for what we do have. Because through that, and only through that, can we change. You can't hoist yourself up. You have to be lifted up. And that is what attunement is really all about.